Are there any questions? All right, if there are no questions, then we will begin the second week. And it will start, oops, I don't have the thing. I'll have to do this manually, so let me just move this over here. We will learn about all the things that you need to do, all the things that you can do to get Java going. How many people have a machine that has Java running on it? Of course, Java is running on the Rockhopper and the machines in the Linux lab. But how many, you have one? Anybody else? It would probably be a good idea if you have a machine at home that you use to install Java on it. That way you can use it locally. Otherwise, you'll be running X over wires over the internet, which is slow and not very responsive. It's not like, yes?
You said it's on a Rockhopper machine.
It's on Rockhopper. It's also,
I use remote access from my house.
Like right, but the problem is if you use anything associated with Java, it's going to open up Windows. Right, and those Windows are going to go over the network back to you. And depending upon where you are, like for me, that's just unusably slow. But if you don't, you know, it's not like C++ where you can open up a terminal and that's it. That's pretty quick, right? But if you use an IDE at all, that's going to open up Windows and lots of Windows, and it's not going to be very responsive. If you don't use an IDE, then you may actually be able to get away with, at least for the initial part of the course, but at some point we're going to start opening up Windows and drawing things. And at that point it becomes really slow. Plus there are some other things that you should probably install, as we'll talk about. It should not. In certain instances, it does, particularly if you're dealing with threads. The schedulers between the various JVMs are different, and they're significantly different from Sun and from Windows, but we're not doing that in this class. So for the most part, it shouldn't matter, which, of course, is never true. But we'll start off by talking about the Java environment. Again, we talked about this briefly last week. I'll bring it up again because we are now going to look at the various parts of the Java environment. I'll spend some time on documentation because that's going to be important. Again, the Java environment is big, so you need to be able to have something that will let you navigate around that environment to figure out what's there, because there's a lot of things that are there that could help you. So it's important for you to know what they are. Then we'll go into talk about various kinds of tools that are available to you, IDEs, integrated development environments, analysis and testing tools. We'll talk a little bit about non-Sun Java parts, tools, and environments. And then we'll discuss scripting. And I'll have a little bit about debugging on the end. Again, this is our abbreviated description of the Java environment. You have a compiler which takes programs and generates class files, which are then sucked into a runtime system, either the JVM or the plugin for the browsers that you have. Or in fact, if you have a browser written in Java, then you don't even need a plugin. But some, for the most part, these will be browsers that contain plugins, which are essentially JVMs and everything else that you need to have it run. The names that we assign to these things from end to end, well, in particular from here to here, is the Java Development Kit, or JDK. Okay, this is previously known as the SDK for either System Development Kit or Software Development Kit. Horstman and Cornell go into, I think, have like a three-quarter page chart of all the abbreviations and the way that the abbreviations have changed over time. Sun Marketing likes to change the name of things in significant ways, so it gets to be annoying after a while, but then you just ignore it. This part is the runtime environment. These will be important. The distinction here is between the system development kit, or the development kits in general, and the runtime environments. The principal difference being you don't get a compiler and the other tools with the runtime environment. So when you're actually installing this, you have to make sure that you get the right package. You have to make sure that you're downloading the JDK as opposed to the JRE. Versions, I mentioned versions. We are going to be dealing with Java version 6. You could also use Java version 5 if you have that laying around. but updating to 6 might actually be of some use, because it's my understanding that the latest version of 6 has better support for browsers, which is not so important for you as it is for me, although actually I haven't quite seen how that support is better. I haven't really gotten into it yet. You can find the version of the Java code that you're using by using the minus version command line argument, both on the JRE, which is called Java, and the compiler, Java C. In this case, this is 1603, and I believe they are now up to 1611. The relevant versions that you'll be dealing with, or might be dealing with, are 1.1. Again, I mentioned that this is obsolete, but you still see examples of, in fact, I saw code this morning. I was going to write it down, but it flicked by too fast. There's actually something out there that still uses Java 1.1, but for the most part, that's obsolete. The two versions of importance are 1.5 and 1.6, which are known as Java 2 Standard Edition 5 and 6. This is the earliest version you should have. If you have anything installed earlier than this, 1.4, for example, then you probably need to upgrade to 1.6. But if you have 1.5, you can just stay with that. That's fine, too. 1.6 is what we'll actually be talking about. And that's the 8th edition of Cornell and Horsman. As I mentioned last time, 1.5, the 7th edition covers 1.5. There are 4 main environments that end-to-end portion of the picture that we saw. The server environment, which is known as the Enterprise Edition, or J2EE. This is what you run on the other side of the server. This is the thing that has all the heavyweight, the Java Bean stuff, all the database stuff. You don't want to install J2EE. You need to install tremendous amounts of stuff. It takes an enormous amount of time. So make sure, and the reason I'm mentioning this is because if you're going to download things, you go to the Java download page, and essentially everything's on one page, so you have to make sure you choose the right thing. So you don't want to choose J2EE, the Enterprise Edition, but that is what it's called. There's the Desktop Edition, J2SE, for Standard Edition. That's what you want. You want to get the Standard Edition. There's also the browser plugin, which comes as part of J2SE, and that gets installed automatically when you install the package for the Standard Edition. And then there's also the Micro Edition, ME, which are for limited devices like handhelds, PDAs, things like that. This course uses the Standard Edition, J2SE5 or 6, as I mentioned. You might want to download the Micro Edition to play with it, although my suspicion is you should probably wait until you understand Java before you actually get to playing around with the Micro Edition. It's actually a small version of Java. Some things are floating point, for example, aren't there, which we're not going to concentrate that much on. So you could actually learn Java from the Micro Edition. The problem is there are not very many books around that are oriented. If I could find one, if I could find it like a Horsman and Cornell for the Micro Edition, I think I would go that way. We would learn from that because I think that would be pretty interesting. But I haven't found them. The most I found are books that will tell you how to write games relative to the Micro Edition in Java. But that's a little too, the books that I've seen anyway are a little too straight to the point and don't really cover the broader areas that I think you should cover in a course like this. So, but certainly once you know your way around the Standard Edition, then certainly downloading the Micro Edition can be an interesting, although quite possibly also frustrating, playing field to deal with. And as I said, we'll be using the Standard Edition here. The Enterprise Edition is actually where you run into all the security things. So I suppose you could use the Enterprise Edition for this class. It doesn't really make much difference, but why go through the agony? The Java system also has extensive documentation. Like I said, it's a big system, and it's got big documentation. You can get the documentation from Sun via the web or by download. Okay, my recommendation is that you actually install a local copy of the documentation on your system so you have fast access. Furthermore, you can also set up alternative searches. I have two or three different ways that I can search the Sun documentation, in particular the API documentation for the class libraries. The web access way gives you one way to do it, but of course you have to run a browser and it's kind of slow and pokey. So I use Glimpse, which is a local search tool to set up various indices into the Sun documentation. So I have different ways of, for example, I can look up everything, all the classes that have a particular method. And you might be able to do that using the browser. There may be some part of the API documentation I missed that allows you to do that. But I didn't see it, and if it's there, it's probably slow because, again, it requires the services of the browser, whereas I can just issue a command line request and get that pretty quickly. You can also print the things out, too, if you want. You can also buy the documentation, known as books. Here's an example. The problem with buying books is that they go out of date distressingly fast, particularly if you buy books that essentially just take the documentation from Sun and reprint it. They reformat it slightly and then reprint it. Those kinds of books are really annoying, but you might find them useful. In fact, one of the books I recommend in the bibliography is the Nutshell books from O'Reilly. They have Java in a Nutshell, I think they call it, and that's essentially just a very terse representation of Java in the class libraries, and it's very handy because you can look things up very quickly. It doesn't tell you a lot, but if you know what you're doing and you've just forgotten something, the Nutshell books are pretty good, but like I said, they tend to go out of date with the next revision. Certainly, if you had a Nutshell for 1.5, then you're probably in good shape for 1.6, but if you have something for 1.4, then you're out of date. You need to buy one that's more recent. You should become adept with some form of documentation. You're going to be looking it up. You're going to be doing this over and over again. Because you're going to be saying, what were the argument orders for that? What was the name of that method? Can I do this with, given that I have a list, is there something that will let me extract from the middle? You'll need to be able to figure out how to answer those questions. One good one that took students last year, can you shuffle it? Can you randomly permute the elements of the array? It took them a while to figure it out. Some people actually said you couldn't do it. And other people said, no, here's the method right there. So documentation types, as I said, there's documentation for everything in the Java system, which means that there's a lot of documentation. What you want to concentrate on are the class library APIs and the JDK. Principally, you're interested in the class library APIs. That's what you're going to be dealing with the most, because that tells you what the classes are, tells you what the methods available for those classes, and so forth. The JDK, for the most part, you're not going to be that interested in because you're not going to be doing things in the JDK. If you were, you would be interested in all the protocols that the JDK defines. Now I'm thinking whether that should be JDK or JVM. No, it should be JDK. JDK is the would be the other things. For example, the command to run applets, which I believe is called applet viewer. So this consists of things like man pages. So you'd have a man page for Java C, you'd have a man page for Java, you'd have a man page for applet viewer. We're going to be making jar files, so you'd have a man page for jar. So you do want to become familiar with both the class library APIs and the man pages. Now, I don't know what they have on Windows systems, or Macintoshes for that matter, but in Unix-based systems, it would install the man pages, so you just say man, Java C, or whatever you're interested in, get the man page for it. There is also web-based documentation, but I don't usually I don't link to that from my browser. I find the man pages to be more convenient. There's other documentation, sample programs, tutorials, white papers, all kinds of stuff. Like I said, you should go to, if you do download the documentation, you should explore a little bit and see what's there. You should also go to the Sun site and see what they have. They have things, that, for example, tutorials they call trails. So you can use those if you have a question that Cornell and Horstman don't answer and I don't answer. You can go, or there's something that you want to learn about that we're not going to talk about, see if the Sun documentation has a trail for it, and you can go through the trail. Sample programs, again, it's good to look at the code that comes. In fact, I was playing with the samples that they have in the JDK when you install it. They have a directory called demo. And then, well, actually, we could probably go there. Let's try that. Oh, that's the other thing I should mention. Nope, I want this. All right, so this is the class directory. Let's see if I can make that bigger. So this is the class directory, public directory. It's in the usual place, export home classes 3.10. It contains most of the things that we'll be talking about and some of the things that we're not. So we'll be talking about Bean Shell, Finebugs, Dr. Java, JUnit. So it has the most recent versions of all of those and some other things. For example, it has the core Java code that he talks about, I believe, in the preface, or maybe it's the first chapter, I forget. But that's already been downloaded for you. And then BlueJ is an alternative IDE that you can use. It's a very simple IDE. It's intended for people who are learning Java, who are learning programming via Java. So this is their first contact with programming. So it's a little bit more hand-holdy and simple than, for example, Dr. Java or Eclipse. But that is not what I wanted to show you. What I wanted to show, I guess I don't know where it is here. Let's see, what can I look up? Let's try this. Yes. And so this, when you install the JDK on your system, you'll get a directory that looks like this. So this is 3 old. If you actually download the most recent one, this should be 11. You'll get something that looks like this. So there's the bin directory that contains all the programs that you get. Oh, I forgot to say list, didn't I? So these are all the things that you get here. There's the compiler. There is the JVM, JavaDoc, something that we'll talk about later. There's the JAR archiving program that creates and takes apart JAR files, Applet Viewer, something that will let you view applets without using a browser, all kinds of other things. JDB, we'll talk a little bit about that. JHAT is a profiler that you can use to examine execution of your program. All kinds of amusing things in here. But what I was talking about is the demo directory here. And you get demos for various aspects of Java. So applets, plugins, scripting, Java Foundation classes. I don't remember what that stands for. Let's see, let's try the foundation classes. Well, there are examples of, for example, swing applet. There's a table example. This is how to play around with the look and feel. Here's the Java 2D stuff. We'll be talking a little bit about that. File chooser demo, things like that. And then you can go down into one of those. And they have the jar file and the sources. So we can run this. Doing this over a internet connection from home, this would be extremely slow. You can certainly do it, no problem. You have to make sure that you SSH into the system properly with the capital X option. Yeah. See, it's slow when we're right here. So you can imagine how slow it's going to be. Man, this is, I don't know what's going on here. This is really slow. Well, let me just put this aside for the moment. Maybe it'll come back and do something useful in a minute. But there's a source directory where you can actually go in and take a look at the code that they use to implement this. So you can get examples of how to use things if you have a question about how something can be used. This is another source of information that you can go to. You can also download the source code for the class libraries. The entire class library is available in source form, so you can download that and look at it too. If you're really into it, you might want to do that, although I really don't recommend you do that until later in the course when you understand what it is you're looking at. Okay, so here we are. Wow, this is idiotically. So I'm wondering if it's not, I don't know, but you can actually, this is interactive, you can actually play with this if we had any kind of speed whatsoever. So sample programs, tutorials, and white papers, as I said. JavaDoc is a tool that will help you document class libraries in the Java style. When you look at the API documentation that you download from Sun, it's all been generated by JavaDoc. So that's the style of documentation that you get out of JavaDoc. If you're really into it, you can make it look really pretty, but we're not going to do that. Although I'll do it because I like to put things like preconditions and postconditions as part of the documentation. And you can actually extend JavaDoc to do that, although I'm actually not going to talk about it in this class. The important thing about, and the reason I mentioned, is that any class library you use or create should be documented. So if you write a class library, you should actually document it using the JavaDoc conventions. And that will actually be important because the Turnin software looks for that stuff and does things based on what it finds. We'll have I'll have more discussion about that in a couple of weeks. JavaDoc. Okay, let's see what we can do here. There we go. All right, so that's the basis of the system. There is an install page. There's actually two install pages on the MUCS wiki. If you go to the help pages, there's something that will tell you how to install this on Linux-based systems. And there's something else that will tell you, there's another page that will tell you how to install it on Windows systems. I don't know anything about Windows, so if you have a problem with Windows, you probably have to go someplace else. But if you have problems on Linux-based systems, I can give you some help there. Anybody run Macintosh here? Anybody run iBooks? So you've installed it? What is that?
I think Apple actually is responsible for it on there.
That was my impression. Yeah. Apple took care of that. So, all right. So integrated development environments. Essentially, they're just hop-up editors. Editors normally take care of this part, right? You can write a program and save it. Then you have to get out of your editor and do everything else. Well, some editors will let you extend that. For example, some editors will let you call the compiler from the editor itself. So you can write your code, and then you can compile it. And then if it's a really good editor, it will get the output from the compiler and point out where your error messages are. So some editors will actually go from here to here. IDEs, on the other hand, go from here all the way to the end. So they allow you to create your programs, compile them, organize them into class libraries, and then actually execute them, usually on the JVE as opposed to the browser. Although there possibly are some IDEs that include development on the browser, particularly if you're dealing with the Google Toolkit, is it? No, it can't be. What's it called? GWT, Google. No, it can't be right either. The Google Web Toolkit, because that actually turns Java into JavaScript, which then runs on the browser. So they may actually go from here to the browser. I don't know how they do that. But for our purposes, we're again just assuming we're going to go from source files to the JVM. So that's all IDE is. There's lots of IDEs. They come in and out yearly. So there's Eclipse, NetBeans, BlueJ, Dr. Java, Emacs plus macros, the Java development environment for Emacs macros, for example. This is what I use. This is why it's here. There are others, including those that you can pay for. These are listed roughly in decreasing complexity. So Eclipse is the most complex of the IDEs around. And I'm not even going to talk about it because it's just so complicated. If you're already running Eclipse, then congratulations, I guess you are. If you're not running Eclipse, I don't know that I recommend that you start now. It might be nice. I don't know. I just think it's way too big. I just think it's too big and bulky. But if you find somebody who is running it and look over their shoulder, then you may see whether or not you like it from that. And then if you do like it, then you can go ahead and endure the pain of installing it and trying to learn it and all these other things. But it's there. It's also on Rockhopper, so you don't have to install it. You can run it on Rockhopper, but again, it's very slow. Even if you're sitting at some terminal here, like for example in the Linux lab, it's slow. I'd imagine it would be awful if you're sitting at home. NetBeans is Java's IDE. It's a very old IDE. It's been around for a long time. It was originally called Forte. I believe there were a company, a third party, that Sun bought and brought in. And then the renaming began. It became Forte, and then Sun Workstation or Workplan or something like that, and they changed the name again. And now the name is NetBeans. You have to be a little careful. When I first saw this, I thought it had something to do with Java Beans. So it's like, oh, I don't care about that. But it turns out it has to do with IDE. And it's not a bad IDE. You can actually, when you go to the download page at Sun, there's a package that says, oh, you can install everything, including NetBeans. So you can get this all in one fell swoop if you want it. Again, it's a little too complicated. It's not as bad as Eclipse, but I think it's just a little too complicated. Next up is Dr. Java, which is what we're going to talk about here. That's the one I like. There are a couple of features that are really nice that I'll point out. And then, as I mentioned, BlueJay is a more introductory, simple IDE. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just it doesn't do all the whizzy things that you would expect it to do. And it does a few things that I find annoying, like projects. It places a lot of emphasis on this idea of projects, which is actually going to get in the way, I think. And then, of course, for the hardcore people, there's Emacs, which is all you need. I will give you one. Do I recommend that you use an IDE? Probably. If you're using an editor that doesn't understand compilation, doesn't allow you to sit there and just say, compile this program and show me if there are any errors, that's about all you need, as far as I'm concerned. On the other hand, you have to do a lot of things to run Java code. You have to make sure class libraries are all set up. You have to make sure class paths are all set up. And most of the IDEs that are oriented towards Java will take care of that for you. And therein lies the danger. I have noticed that people that rely on IDEs don't really understand what's going on beneath the IDE. In other words, they don't know what the IDE is doing for them. And that can be a problem, because you need to understand how class paths work. If you don't, you're going to be in a lot of trouble, both in this class and when you go out into the wide world, because class paths are a real source of pain. It's the Java version of what Microsoft calls DLL hell, right? Except it doesn't have to do so much with the DLLs themselves as the paths that it takes to get to the class files, which is why it's called the class path. So even if you use a IDE, one of the whizzy ones like NetBeans or Eclipse, make sure you understand what it's doing, which can be difficult. It can be hard to figure out what that little devil's doing for you. But it's important that you do understand it, because those are concepts you need to know in order to be a proficient Java programmer. All right, so I'll give you that little word of warning. And I spent, last year, there was some student who didn't do very well because they didn't understand ClassPass. And they would say things like, yeah, but it worked at home. And I said, I have absolutely no doubt it worked at home, but it doesn't work here. And that's the problem. It needs to work here. And, of course, the reason it didn't work is because they didn't understand what they were supposed to submit. And they were supposed to submit their package directories, and they didn't. They submitted their project directories, which was a loss. So you need to be able to make sure you understand what your IDE is doing for you. Midway between BlueJay and Eclipse is Dr. Java, sort of the happy medium. It's a relatively simple IDE for Java. As I pointed out, it's available in the class directory. And you run it with this command file. It's in a jar file, so this is how you run jar files. You give the name of the JVM, which in this case is Java. Then you say minus jar to indicate that I want you to execute a jar file. And then the name of the jar file. And that will let you run a program in a jar file. When you do that, you get something that looks like this. Pretty much looks like, and it's much simpler than, for example, the IDE that coughs up when you run Eclipse. But, you know, it lets you do whizzy things like, oh, pick a different compiler. I don't want to do that. Don't bother me with that stuff. And it gives you this kind of information, which is important. You need to understand, because if you notice, there were two versions of Java installed on Rockhopper. There was 1.5 and 1.6, so you want to make sure that you're dealing with the appropriate version, which, for the most part, is taken care of automatically. But, again, you want to make sure that that's the case when you trust your IDE to do it for you. All right, I showed you how to do it yourself. You just say, well, what version is Java? And it will tell you. But here, you've got to rely on the IDE to get it right. It's got very nice help, which is part of the system. This is separate from the documentation that you get from Sun. You can invoke the help and then click around. It's got a quick start guide to get you going. I should say that if you want to download Dr. Java, or in fact any of the packages in the class directory, now I have to be careful, I should say probably course directory, those are all available. So if you take a look in the Dr. Java directory, there should be a tar file or maybe a jar file, I'm not sure, that you can just copy and take home with you and install, as opposed to going to, I guess it's Rice University and downloading the most recent version, although you could also do that too. Here are some of the nice things that an IDE can do. So I wrote this code, and I forgot I made a mistake here. And I said, all right, compile it for me, pushing a magic button, which is, I don't know where, somewhere up there, some magic keystroke or something. And I found an error. It said, oops, you're missing a semicolon here. So it sort of says, here's the problem, tells you what it is, and then leaves it up to you to actually put in the semicolon. All right, so that's the kind of thing an IDE does. Again, any reasonable editor should do this for you. Perhaps even VI does this. I don't know.
Vim does.
Oh, it does? Okay. But it's VI improved, right? So you would expect it to do that. Here is the reason I like Dr. Java as opposed to, for example, BlueJay. And that's this thing, it's called interaction. This is actually a listener, what's called a listener or a REPL, read, eval, print loop. And essentially what it allows you to do is it allows you to take this code that you've been editing and treat it as if it's been entered into the system. So this code defines a class called employee. And what I can do is I can create an employee by issuing the new command, which is how you create class instances, passing in the appropriate arguments, Joe Blow and a salary of $50,000, and then I can store that in a variable. So this is like, if you're familiar with interactive basic or, you know, any Python, anything that has an interactive evaluation loop, this is the same thing, except it includes the programs you're writing, the class files you're writing. So you can actually fool around with things. You can, for example, call the get salary method, which I don't know if I show that here. Yes. So you can call the get salary method. You can call raise salary by 10%. And then you can call get salary again. And sure enough, it looks like it works. So this allows you to sort of fool around and look at your classes that you're writing, see if they work. And you can do it in an interactive way. This is very nice because the alternative, of course, is to write Java code to do this. And writing Java code is a pain, even if you use an IDE, because you have to define a class, and then you got to remember, oh, I need to make this main because I'm going to run it by itself. Whereas if you just sit here and type, you're done. And you can play around with it. You can try and change things and see whether or not it works. So this is a very nice feature of Dr. Java. And in fact, it may be in, does Eclipse have a similar thing? Yeah, probably does. See, that's the other thing. You got to go out and find it. But we're actually going to talk about something that has similar properties to this at the end of this lecture. We'll talk about scripting, interactive scripting languages, as another alternative tool that you might want to be able to use. But this is the reason I like Dr. Java. It's got this interaction that allows you to play around with your code, see whether or not it works. also lets you explore the various features of Java. So if you're interested in a particular class and you want to know how it works, you know, what, for example, you've got the documentation for it, but you don't quite understand what it's doing, you can create an instance of it and then call a couple of methods associated with it and call a couple of query methods to see what it does. So you can play around with it interactively. And again, that's very nice because, first of all, it's open. It allows you to play and call things at will. Second of all, you don't have to write all the boilerplate that you have to write when you write Java programs. So that's the reason I like Dr. Java. All right, that's it for IDEs. Anybody have any questions about that? Again, you need to have something, so if you want to fool around with a real IDE, try Dr. Java. Or if you don't want to make that grand investment, certainly try a BlueJay. Analysis and testing. One of the nice things about Java, particularly over C++, is that it analyzes and tests well. And by that I mean you can write code to analyze Java programs. You can also write code to test Java programs, and that's not very hard. It's very hard to do in C++. C++ is an incredibly complicated parse. So the first problem you have is just taking your C++ program apart, because that's one of the first things you need to do in order to be able to analyze it. You take your program apart and figure out, for example, where all the statements are, and then you can insert things around those statements to test various properties that you're interested in, or only a subset of those statements that, for example, manipulate a variable. That's very hard to do in C++ because it's a very difficult parse. And even once you have it parsed, it's also difficult to do because of the semantics and also because you have a preprocessor in there. Java doesn't have any of those problems. It's very easy to parse. Well, it's actually getting less easy, but it's still pretty easy to parse. And it also is fairly easy because of the JVM and the interfaces it provides, as we'll talk about later on, to do various kinds of analysis. I mentioned one of them, such as that is throwing exceptions for example, null pointer access or array accesses. So the testing and analysis tools span everything. There's static analysis tools that you can run on your Java code, your Java programs, and they'll go all the way through to tools that you can run on your program while it's executing in a JVM. Not less so in the browser. But again, there are some debuggers that you can run from the browser as an adjunct to the code that you're running in the plugin. What we're going to be talking about are two of those tools. One is called FindBug, which essentially is a static analysis tool that runs on the class library. So it's not, you have to run it through the compiler to get class libraries, and we'll analyze the class libraries. And then we'll talk about JUnit, which is something that allows you to write tests that execute when you run the code, the associated code. And like I said, there are lots of other ones that you could use. I'll leave it up to you to go out and to explore. But of the two that are, I think, for us, most important, certainly, are FindBugs and JUnit. FindBugs is a static analyzer for errors and infelicities in Java code. For those of you who are old Unix programmers, FindBugs is sort of equivalent to lint, if you remember what lint is. Static analyzer means you don't have to run the code itself. In other words, you have the source code, or you have, in this case, class files. You don't have to actually execute those. What you do is you parse them and analyze them for various properties that you can determine by the structure, the static structure of either the source code or the class file. That's why it's called static analysis. The alternative is dynamic analysis, where you actually run the code and figure out what it's doing. For example, how many times it iterates in a loop. Which is what I say here. Static means the analyzed code is not executed. It's merely parsed and picked apart. I will be running your assignments through FindBugs. FindBugs is wired into, this is one of the differences between the turn-in this semester and last semester. FindBugs is wired into the turn-in code for this semester. So whenever you submit code, it goes through FindBugs. As I mentioned, it's available in the class directory. I don't know if this is the most recent version. I had it in mind to change this, but whatever is in the class directory is the most recent version of FindBugs. As we will see, it's written at the University of Maryland, so if you want to actually download your own copy, and again, the whatever it is, the tar file or the jar file that you need to do this, to install FindBugs, is available in this directory also. Or you can go to the University of Maryland. I believe there's a link on the lecture notes to it. Now here's what FindBugs looks like. In this case, this is the employee class that I was working on last time, and I run it through FindBugs, and it tells me that I have an infelicity, not an error. There's nothing wrong. Well, this code will execute, but it has the potential to execute incorrectly, so it's not so much an error as an infelicity. I'm not going to talk about this now because we don't have the appropriate background to understand what's going on, but essentially what's happening is I am implementing an interface called compares, or comparable. Okay? And a comparable has a contract. There are a set of rules that you have to follow if you want to use comparable correctly, and I'm not using one of those rules. I am not defining my own equals. Okay, I'm relying on object equals, which it turns out is not specific enough to satisfy the comparable interface. So it's, and if you actually read this, it will tell you what's wrong. So it gives you a nice explanation of what you're doing wrong. All right, so having identified that as an error, I go into my trusty browser, and you notice the error was I didn't have my own equals. I didn't have my own equals in the employee class. I was relying on inheritance to give me object equals. So the way to fix this is you stick your own equals in the employee class, which is what I do here. So I install or I insert an equals for the employee class. Can you make that bigger, maybe? Nah, let me not fool around with it. And then I run FindBugs again. It doesn't choke on the equals with respect to comparable, but it does choke on the fact that I have implemented equals and I have not implemented hash code. This is an error. This is something that it's bad to do, because if you do it, your code won't work, and it won't work in very mysterious ways. So the problem here is that the class itself has an equals. And whenever you a class defines an equals, it also needs to define hash code. And again, we'll talk about why that's the case when, I don't know when we do that. Maybe when we get to classes, I think in a couple of weeks. But this is an error. So this, again, and it points out here that, well, here's the definition of equals, but there is no associated definition of hash code. And you can see how you can do this statically, right? You look at the class file, you look at the methods, you see that, oh, there's an equals method, but I don't see any hash code method. So that's something that needs to be flagged. And again, it explains why this is a problem. So we hop back into the editor, and I don't have to actually hop back into the, is that true? I was just going to say, I don't have to actually hop back, because you notice what I'm doing is I'm flicking back and forth between Emacs and FindBugs. And I'm wondering if I can just stay in FindBugs and fix this. I'm under the impression I can't. I think I tried to do it last year, and it didn't work. So you do have to actually hop back and forth. So you hop back into the editor, and here's hash code. So now I've implemented hash code, which does the obvious thing. It just hashes on the name and returns that. Call FindBugs once again, and it comes up clean. So at least with respect to FindBugs, there are no more errors or infelicities. All right, so again, if you're familiar with Lint or any of the static code checking tools, FindBugs should be fairly familiar to you. And it's inordinately configurable. You can ignore certain errors or emphasize other errors, and you can format the way the errors are reported and all that other stuff, but you don't really have to get into it that much in order to get some use out of it. Another alternative, I said that FindBugs was wired into the code for Turnin, but you don't want to wire in something that's got a GUI. So there is actually another version of FindBugs or another interface to FindBugs that is command line based. And this is actually what I do. I don't flick back and forth between the FindBugs GUI and Emacs. I just run it from Emacs itself. So if you do this, you get a similar error message. Of course, it's not quite as nicely formatted, but it points out that employee defines compare to and uses object equals. So now we're back to the original problem that we had. But this is what you will see when you have an infelicity or an error when you submit something. You will get these messages. And to forestall the inevitable and irritating question, yes, if it's on your turn-in report, you have to fix it, because I try and strip out all the ones that you should probably ignore, so you don't see those. So if you see them, you need to fix them. Let's see if I can make this bigger. Nope, too big. Oh, now I'm stuck? Oh, come on. All right, so that's FindBugs. Any questions about that? And if you're running Eclipse, I believe Eclipse will absorb FindBugs. That's the other thing. Some IDEs are more absorptive than others. So, for example, Eclipse, I believe, just latches on to anything you've got laying around. So you can run the GUI FindBugs from Eclipse. And when we get to debuggers, I'll talk about running. Usually you can run a particular debugger from your IDE. But the Java compiler itself has a lint-like feature, which is called lint, and you can run it using the minus capital X command option, command line option. So minus X lint gives you checks that are similar to FindBugs. They're not as detailed or not as thorough as they are in FindBugs, but they're also a little bit more targeted. In other words, Sun knows what mistakes people will make over and over and over again, so they make sure that if they can check for those statically, they do. So you tend to get less, well, I don't want to say you get a lot of false positives with respect to FindBugs, but certainly you'll get, however many you get, you'll get less of them if you run excellent. It's just that you won't get as many positives or true positives as you'd like. On the other hand, it doesn't cost you anything, right? You just set up your editor when it says call Java C, you just include the minus X lint option. And that's what I do in Emacs. I don't know if it showed that or not. Let's see. No, this is the FindBugs. I don't know if I have an example of running. Oh, maybe I do. No, I guess I don't. Okay. Oh, there's one last thing which I thought was cute. I was doing something, I don't remember what. Oh, I was trying to run FindBugs to get some to look at the output it got, to look for a good example. So I was in this directory, which I believe is one of Horstman's directories. Okay, so this is code from one of Horstman's directories, and given that it has inner classes there, I would suspect it's from a later, like chapter 8 or 9. But anyway, I said, fine, let me just look through this code and see if I can find any interesting errors to use as a demo. So I did. I said, give me FindBugs, text UI, which is how you run the textual version as opposed to the graphical user interface version, and then just run it over all the classes. Now, of course, the problem there is that there are no classes. I didn't compile anything. All right, so what happens? FindBugs explodes. This is what happens when you get an explosion in C++. This is the equivalent of a core dump in C++. This is what you get in Java. You get an exception stack trace, which I thought was funny, because this is something that will help you write good, solid code, and it explodes itself on a fairly obvious mistake. So what I had to do was go through and compile the code. I didn't actually have to do it this way, but I wasn't sure about the relationship among all the classes, so this is probably the cheapest way to do it. And then call find bugs again, and it worked fine. And it turns out that this code had no problems with it. Oh, except here's one. It defines compare to and uses object. Oh, maybe this is where I got that initial error message from. Okay, so maybe this is how I found that initial example. Okay, so this is a perfect illustration of the cobbler's children having no shoes. In fact, what it should have done was something like this. Oh, sorry, can't find any. And once you begin to play around with Java, you understand exactly how that problem occurs. People will call a file picker class that is responsible for returning some subset of files that you should operate on, and that class is empty. It contains null. And so this is an example of where you run into problems passing back a null. And of course, the code that called the file picker says, all right, now I'm going to get a file and work on it. So it gets a null pointer and tries to work on it by, for example, peeling off the directory, and boom, it explodes. Actually, let's see what the error was. Let's see if we can read this. Probably not. What is the... So there was an IO exception. No, this is too complicated. This is the other problem, is that this assumes you understand how findbugs is implemented if you want to read this. All right, so that's too complicated to figure out. So what it should have done is just given you a nice little error message, which means you should never trust your code, even if it's Java, even if it's sort of reliable. You should never trust the values you get from anything. You should check and make sure. There are some other problems with that, I suspect. Again, this is all speculation because I don't actually know how it's written. But after... And this is a good way to make Java code explode. Whenever you're offered the opportunity to pick a file, don't pick any files and just return. See what happens. And you can explode files. You can explode Java programs with great regularity that way. Here's an example. JUnit. This is the second of our two testing and analysis tools. In this case, we're actually going to do testing. The findbugs was more of an analysis tool. JUnit is a unit testing framework for Java. Unit test, those of you that took software engineering, did they talk about unit testing? Okay, so you know what unit testing is. For those of you that didn't take software engineering, unit tests are essentially tests on small portions of a system, where small portions of a system defined by the system you're working on. For example, if you're writing C code, they would probably be individual functions. Because that's the structure of a C program. If you're working in Java, then the unit test would be in units of a class, and you would break that up possibly into units of methods within a class. So, for example, you could write unit tests on individual methods, and then you can write a unit test on the entire class. Generally speaking, you're not going to write unit tests on larger pieces of structure, for example, packages, because then that gets into things like not iteration testing, but integration testing, things like that. But it's a fluid boundary, so you can sort of do what you'd like. As I say here, Java, the unit's usually a class. Again, JUnit is available in the class directory, as is the package that you would download if you want to install it on your own system. And where possible, assignments will have JUnit tests. So that's one of the reasons why you should be familiar with JUnit. I was actually kind of disappointed. They went to JUnit version 4, which has a really stripped down and bare interface. In fact, it's a little too stripped down, which is one of the reasons why I didn't use it much last year, because I felt the interface was too raw for the students to pick up, particularly if they weren't familiar with the concepts of unit testing. But this year, we might actually be able to push it a little bit further. What does it look like? Can people read that? I can't make it bigger, unfortunately, because that doesn't work. So what we have here, again, is our employee class, and it has a bunch of methods associated with it. Get the person. So we create an employee that can, where is it? We create an employee that has a name and a salary. And once we create it, we can do things like get the name of the employee, get the employee's salary. We can increase the employee's salary, or by passing in a number less than one, decrease the employee's salary, and do some other things, do some housekeeping things like the equals, the hash code, so forth, because this implement's comparable. So this is a pretty straightforward implementation of a class. This would be a unit, and we would like to test it. So then we would write some unit tests using the various facilities available in JUnit. We would create just some class, a test class, up to you as to what it was named. In version 3, you had to give it specific names, but here you can give it whatever you want. Then we would use annotations to indicate these are the tests we want to run, and in this case, we're doing a test on the salary. So I'm creating an instance of an employee with a particular name at a particular salary, and then I am increasing that employee's salary, and then I'm checking to make sure that the employee's salary is, in fact, his initial salary times the increase. Similarly, with respect to the name, I'm creating an employee with a particular name and a particular salary. And then once that employee is created, I'm checking to make sure that the name I get back is equal to the name I used to create. Again, these are simple tests. And I want to emphasize, and I will emphasize over and over again, simple tests are best. You don't need tests more complicated than this. So when you write unit tests, when you write any kind of test, just do the simple things, because you'll screw those up. And those are the things you want to screw up, because then you can get them early, you can fix them, and be more careful. So simple testing is best. You don't have to do really complicated, convoluted things. You can actually make this easier. You can have what are known as testing prefixes. You notice I'm repeating code here. I'm creating an employee in two different tests. Well, you can extract those out into a prefix, a test prefix, where you create a single employee that you can then reuse over and over again in the various tests. Again, these are so simple that it's not an issue. If you're testing millions of lines of code every day, that becomes important, but for our purposes, this is just fine. On the other hand, if you want to get more into it, you certainly can. All right, so those are my test cases. What do? I compile it. It's Java code. I compile it into a class file, and then I run it, which you run it like this. And this is the name of the class file that has the tests. And it runs the two tests, and it tells me, oh, great, nothing, no problems. So the two tests passed. So at least with respect to the tests that I implemented, that code was correct. So let's go back, and because one of the things I know, I don't trust things. When I see that the test works correctly, I was like, there's two things, right? Either my code was correct, or the tests I wrote weren't good enough to detect any errors. I mean, that's the other problem you might have. So usually when that happens, usually when I write a test and it comes up clean, the first thing I'll do is I go and I'll break my code just to make sure the tests work. So in this case, I'll break get name to return the null or the empty string, not the null string. Those are different. So this should clearly break the class, the employee class, at least with respect to the test that I've written. So we run the test, and surely enough, it blows up. Gives you a whole bunch of errors. There was one test failure, and the test that failed was the name test, which is good because that's what we broke. So now I know to go back and look, at least look at the test, get some idea of what was wrong, and then go back to the actual code and fix it. And in version 3, what you would get is you got a GUI. You got a button. You got two buttons. You push the run button, and then you would get either a green bar or a red bar. And if you got a red bar, there were errors. If you got a green bar, everything was great. But this is a little bit more threadbare than the GUI interface in version 3. All right, so that's it for fine bugs. You can really get into it. You can do all kinds of things. There's all kinds of annotations apart from tests. But again, simple things work well. So tips on testing. First of all, do it. Test your code. Write lots of small, simple tests and run them all the time. It's helpful, again, if you have I know Eclipse will understand, although actually, last time I looked, they were having trouble with, they didn't actually update to JUnit version 4. My assumption is they've done that in the year that I've looked at it. So you can, again, integrate JUnit tests into Eclipse very easily, so you just push a button and everything runs. But if you're not using Eclipse, or if you don't want to use Eclipse, or if you don't want to include it in Eclipse, you can do other things like make files. I just put it in a make file, and I type make test, and it runs, and I'm happy. or unhappy as the case may be, depending upon the results of the test. So the first thing to do, so you should write tests in two stages. First of all, write tests that are obvious to with respect to the things that you're testing. So again, if you have something called get name, write a test that makes sure that the name you get is equal to the name you put in. All right, those are pretty straightforward. Doesn't require a lot of brain power to write those kinds of tests. Once you get all those to execute correctly, then what you should do is, as you make mistakes, as you find errors in your code, the first thing you should do is write a test to replicate that error. So if for some reason you get a, for example, null pointer access error, figure out why you got that null pointer access error, and then write a test that exactly replicates that condition. Right, so when you run the test, it'll blow up. Then fix the error. Okay, run your test again. It should work. And that's what I do. That is extremely important for two reasons. First of all, it gives you a source of auxiliary errors. But more importantly, you're learning about yourself. I don't know if you've noticed, you should be noticing by now, you've written enough code, you probably make a particular set of errors that are, it turns out, characteristic to you. I know what set of errors I usually make. Okay, and you also should, if you should be able to answer the question after a while, what errors are you most likely to make when you write a particular piece of code? Okay, and that's going to differ from person to person. You should be able to understand what those errors are. And this is one way to do that. Just when you make an error, stop and say, why is this error here? Reproduce it and then fix it. In addition, this is the cockroach theory of error testing, right? If you step on a cockroach, you haven't solved the problem because there's never one cockroach. There's always more. They're just, you don't see them. If you have an error in your code and you fix it, you haven't solved the problem because there are more errors. And what's worse, you're going to reintroduce that same error again the next time you write that piece of code. And so you want to make sure that once you fix the error, it stays fixed. So these are two reasons. There turns out lots of other reasons why once you have an error, once you discover an error, you should first the first thing you should do, well, is understand why it's the error, then replicate it as a test, and then fix it. And then finally, develop code in measured steps and keep the test up to date. This is another way of saying take small steps. Take really small steps, ridiculously small steps, and make sure that each step is outlined by a test. Questions about that? All right. We'll now take a look at some other versions of Java that you might want to run. For the most part, probably not, but I will mention them anyway. And there is actually one that you might want to consider. So Sun encourages independent implementation of Java parts, right? They make the specs available and they make reference implementations available. They want to encourage people to implement, for example, JVMs. They want to be able to spread Java around all over the place. So they are supportive of people implementing other bits of, or implementing bits and pieces of the Java system. On the other hand, you do have to be careful. Names are still protected and licensed. So if you decide to implement a new JVM, you're not allowed to call it Java because that name is already taken. And in fact, you can't even say it's like Java because that would mean you have a license to call it that. So you'd have to say it runs, you know, it conforms to the JVM spec or something like that. You'd have to be circumeloquent. You could also submit it to Sun to have it actually accepted as a licensable piece of software, but I suspect that probably costs money. Alternative implementations may have more appropriate properties based on what it is you're looking for. And I'll have some examples of that as we look at the various alternatives that you have. For our purposes, it's not going to make much difference. The only place where it does make a difference is with respect to the compiler. And so for the most part, I'm just sort of mentioning this as completeness because for completeness sake, because it actually is not going to affect us that much. On the other hand, is anybody running weird things like OpenBSD? Any weird operating systems? Non-standard operating systems, if you will? Then this actually might be important because Sun really only supports Windows, Linux systems, and Solaris. So if you're running anything else, you're going to have problems. Somebody either has to step up to the plate and help you, as in the case of Macintoshes, or you're on your own. You have to cobble it together somehow, as in the case of OpenBSD. I'm running OpenBSD next door, so that's why I know that. All right, JVMs are probably the most common alternative implementations around. There's a fair number of JVM implementations. This is particularly true when you have non-PC-like hardware. If you don't have your standard box and you want to run Java, then you have a trick of, as I said, Sun only supports the big three. Well, actually, I question how big Solaris is, but let's assume it's a big three. Sun only runs those three operating systems. So if you have something, if you have an iPhone, for example, although I guess Sun has actually managed to get, they haven't?
No, it's iPhone, I think you compile, you run Objective-C on that.
Yes, but
they won't let you, it's like Apple won't let them develop the JVM for it.
But I thought they did anyway.
I think they are able to, and they have a version running, but they're not allowed to release
it. Right, they're not allowed to release it, right. But there's a case of where you just can't download the 1.6 JVM and stick it on the iPhone because there are things not on the iPhone that the standard JVM would expect. And furthermore, there are things not on the iPhone. And furthermore, you don't have enough resources. So the things that are on the iPhone, you probably don't have enough of them to run standard Java. Similarly, if you're running, what's the GumSticks? If you have a GumSticks machine, the machine that runs Linux, it's about as big as a GumStick. You can put the JVM on that. It's just you have to strip it down a lot. There are lots of reasons for implementing alternative JVMs. They could be motivated by research into performance or curiosity. It's a good way to learn about the JVM. The good way to learn about anything is to implement one of them. Or licensing problems. A lot of people were pissed off, particularly in the open software world, about Sun's licensing for Java. So they got all huffy, as they usually do, and went off on their own. That's what the GNU people did. So, for example, two fairly well-known alternative implementations to the JVM are Jikes, which was originally implemented at IBM. They were interested in very high performance out of the JVM, so that's where Jikes came from. They wanted very good performance out of that. After that was for the, I think it was called the Jalapeno project. After they got it to work, at least to their satisfaction, they released it as open source, and it's now available from SourceForge, I believe. There's a link on the lecture notes that you can follow if you're interested in that. Another one is Cafe, which is a clean room implementation of the JVM and class libraries. These were some of the people who are sort of upset about the licensing, as well as the knowledge that you would gain by implementing a JVM and class libraries. And there's lots of other ones, but these are the two that are probably the best known. They're certainly the longest lived. Some of these projects come into existence and then flicker out after about a year. But these two have been around for a reasonable amount of time, certainly at least 5 years. Remember our picture, we're working from right to left. So I've talked about the runtime. Now we're going to talk about the class libraries. The best known independent implementation of the class libraries is the GNU ClassPath project. And again, these are people who are upset over the licensing for Sun. So they say, all right, we'll do it ourselves. So it's an almost complete re-implementation of the class libraries. There's a few pieces that are not there, at least last time I checked. You will find that almost any other re-implementation includes the GNU ClassPath libraries. That's not true for Cafe. Cafe has their own separate implementation of the libraries. But for most of the other JVMs that provide you with a JVM knockoff, they also include the GNU ClassPath library. Or you could also use Suns, for that matter, if you wanted to. Because all ClassPaths, once you get them to a ClassPath form, all class files, once you get them correctly into the class file form, are indistinguishable. In addition, you have third parties that provide libraries to extend the standard class libraries, either extend them or replace them. A good example of that is the SWT library, which stands for Standard Window Toolkit Library from Eclipse. So Eclipse decided, well, we're not going to use the AWT. We don't like it, so we'll implement our own. They did. They implemented the SWT. So there's an alternative toolkit that you can use if you don't like the AWT. And then there are just third-party libraries that provide facilities that the class library doesn't. And the third part, which is the part that is of most interest to us, is the non-Sun Java compilers. The principal non-Sun compiler is the GNU compiler for Java, or GCJ. This is based on the GCC compiler, so in a sense it's a front end. It compiles Java code to either bytecode or native code, and this is the thing that makes the GCJ interesting, is you can just go right down into native code, which means that you get the associated improvements in speed as opposed to interpreting bytecode on a JVM. So you get fast compilation and execution because, again, GCJ itself is not a Java program. And if you go to native code, you're running without overhead. Furthermore, you get perhaps familiar debugging. If you know how to debug in GDB, then you can include debugging symbols in the compiled code if you go native, and then you can use GDB to debug your code if you have a problem with it. In addition, there are a lot of compilers or translators that go from bytecode to native. So given a set of class files that execute as a program, you can translate the whole thing into native code and run it quickly. We don't care about these because we're not that, first of all, we're not that interested in speed here. But I'll just mention it to indicate the kinds of flexibility you have in playing around with Java code. And then again, there are many compilation and execution-oriented tools. For example, you can think of Findbugs as an example of one of those that, actually probably not. Scratch the Findbugs. But things like code obfuscators, and so you write some intellectual property as a Java program, you translate it into class files, and then there's another class of compiler tools, which are called decompilers. They take a look at a class file and generate perhaps the most likely form of Java that would generate that class file. So you can, in a sense, figure out how a class file was written by decompiling it into Java code. And of course, people who have intellectual property invested in their class files don't like that, because that essentially means that they'll be able to, other people will be able to decompile their code and figure out how they wrote it. So there are a class of translators known as obfuscators, which take your class file, and possibly your Java code too, but there's really no reason to ship Java code around. And if you do, then you're presumably not worried about your IP. But certainly take class file code and make it extremely difficult to decompile by doing all kinds of whizzy things. But of the all possibilities discussed on this slide, the one that's perhaps of greatest interest is GCJ. On occasion, I do use GCJ to compile my programs because, again, if I have an error that I just can't figure out, I can use the big hammer of GDB and do it that way. But for the most part, that isn't necessary. We will now move on to another particularly nifty set of tools known as scripting languages. I know some of you have some experience with scripting languages. A scripting language is essentially a language designed to be implemented by an interpreter. Now, that's not a very good definition, and we can get into huge arguments about what a scripting language is. I don't really care. For our purposes, this is what I think a scripting language is. This is different from a language that can be interpreted. Right? Just because you have a language that's interpreted doesn't necessarily mean you have a scripting language. On the other hand, maybe it does. Again, I'm not really that interested in it, but I will just mention those differences. The absence, and the reason that's important, the principal characteristic that I'm interested in with respect to scripting languages is that there is no edit, compile, link, execute cycle. Okay, this is what you get in Java. If you remember our picture, right? You have Java code, so you edit it, you compile it, and then you, in a sense, link it together in the JVM, and then you execute it. And it doesn't work. So you go back to the beginning, and you edit, and then you compile, and link, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. What you have with a scripting language is a very short edit-execute. You edit some code, you run it. You edit the code, run it. So you have a very tight loop, and that turns out to be a very productive way to deal with code because you knock out all these things that you don't really care about, compilation, linking. Who cares about that stuff? Just edit the code, run it. This is the principal advantage, and this is what I think of as a scripting language. So it's something that has this very tight cycle. So there are other advantages to scripting languages, though. You have a relaxed syntax, and you have a pragmatic semantics. This is particular, and this is why I'm mentioning scripting languages here, is the fact that you can relax the Java syntax and get pragmatic semantics. This makes it a lot nicer to write Java code, as I will demonstrate. Well, heck, the JVM is an interpreter, right? It interprets bytecodes. Well, that's great. So what we do is we take a language and we translate it into bytecodes and then run it or interpret it on the JVM. Now, the reason you might want to do that is that JVM bytecode is high level. It's a stack-based architecture. It's a very high-level architecture, which means that if you have some particular language, the JVM bytecode is not that far beneath the abstraction facilities of that language, which means the bridge that you need to build to go from your language to the JVM bytecode is not that large. It's certainly a lot smaller than the bridge you need to build to go from your language to, for example, x86 assembly. Furthermore, the JVM is really nice. I mentioned previously in the previous lectures that JVM is slick, and what I meant by slick was it's portable, and it's got lots of features. In fact, essentially, it's got the entire class library available to you. And that's all free. You don't have to do any work. It comes with the JVM itself. So by climbing on top of the JVM and working up from there, you have essentially accomplished a tremendous amount of You have created a tremendous amount of features for a relatively small amount of work. And as I indicated, you get free and immediate access to all the available class libraries, which is the other nice thing about scripting languages. At least scripting languages that run on the JVM that are implemented to take advantage of that feature. So what are these languages I'm talking about? There are lots of them based on the JVM. Some of them are familiar. For example, you just take your favorite scripting language and stick a J in front of it. So there's JPython, Jackal, which is slightly different. That's the Java implementation of TCLTK, JScheme, JRuby, and so on and so forth. Okay, and then there are some that are less so. So these, I mean, if you know what Python is, you know what JPython is, except for the extensions to access the features associated with the JVM, in particular the class libraries. If you know what Scheme is, you know what JScheme is. If you know what Ruby is, you know what JRuby is. And these can take Python. So if you have Python programs, you can run them on JPython. But that doesn't sort of exploit the extra advantages that I've been talking about. Then you have some languages that are less familiar, or perhaps less familiar, Groovy, Bean Shell, Peanuts, and so forth. Okay, which one of these, well, apart from these two, which one you use is actually a matter of features available to you and choice. Features and which one you prefer. In other words, whether you prefer writing functional style or Python-ish style or Ruby-ish style, it's up to you. I'm actually going to be talking about these down here because I think these are more appropriate for the kinds of interactions that you might want to go through while you're in this class. Course, I suppose I should say. And in particular, I'm going to look at the Bean Shell. The only reason I'm going to look at the Bean Shell is because that is the interpreter that comes with JDEE, the Java Development Environment for Emacs. It comes with Bean Shell, and so I made no choice. It was just there, so that's what I use. The Bean Shell is an example of a scripting language. It contains an interpreter, so you can sit at a command prompt and issue commands, get responses back. So you can, this is an interactive way of dealing with code as opposed to, for example, the edit execute cycle. This, or another way to look at it, this is a much tighter edit execute cycle. And again, the Bean Shell is available in the class directory. So what's so hot here? The first one is variables can be introduced as needed. So there's no declaration. This is an example of relaxed syntax and semantics. Unlike Java, where every variable you use has to be declared someplace, you can just introduce variables in the Bean Shell and in other scripting languages. Okay, the scripting environment is responsible for keeping track of them as you use them. Okay. Furthermore, variables are also dynamically typed. I don't have to do any declarations, which makes sense because I can just use them without declaring them. Some languages will actually let you issue declarations, so that you can improve the script robustness. In other words, always ensure that, for example, if you declare this variable to be a string, that you always assign strings to it. And furthermore, you can also, if you're really worried about it, improve efficiency, because you can eliminate the tests that says, okay, what type is this variable? That's the first question you have to ask when you have a variable and you get the value associated with that. What type is that value? If you tell it it's always going to be a string, then it can skip those tests and therefore be a little bit more efficient anyway. So here's an example of that. In this case, I'm using stuff from Swing. Okay, so I just say I'm going to create a new J-frame, which is, in a sense, you can think of it as a piece of screen real estate. We'll talk about this all the way at the end of the semester. But notice here, here's a variable, frame. Boom, that's it. I create a J-frame and stick the reference to that in frame. I don't have to declare what it is. I don't have to do anything. I just have frame. Then I can create a button. And this is the syntax. This is the one of the constructors available for the JButton class. This is one of the constructors for JFrame. So in that sense, you're dealing with Java classes. And what else do I do? Now I put the button in the frame. Then I pack the frame so that you can actually see it. And then I set the frame to visible, and there it is. All right, so there's, what is that, 6 lines of code, and I can actually get something up I can play with. This is one of the reasons I'm talking about scripting languages like this, or interactive scripting languages, because it lets you get Java programs, or at least pieces of Java code, up and running very quickly. So it's a very nice environment for exploring. Again, if you remember back to Dr. Java, I said that it had that little interaction panel down the bottom. That was the reason I liked Dr. Java. This is a similar thing. The other nice thing about the scripting environments is that they're dynamic. A scripting environment can be updated dynamically and iteratively. And you can do this in a number of different ways, certainly one obvious way is just by assigning different values to variables. And, of course, this is the basis of a scripting language's exploratory nature. For example, if you want a data structure and you're not exactly sure which one you want, well, you just create, for example, a queue. And then you try a couple of experimental operations on this queue to see if it's doing what you want. And if it's not, then you just throw the queue away and create, I don't know, a stack. See if that works. So you can very quickly, on the fly, create things and experiment with them. And if they don't work, throw them away and go on to the next thing. If you think about trying to write that in terms of Java code that compiles and executes, it's a lot slower. Or, for that matter, C or C++. Right. Similarly, it's a lot slower iterative cycle, which means that it's a lot more of a pain to do, whereas this is very lightweight, and you can sort of fool around with it and go. So here's an example. I created this button, right? But it doesn't do anything. Now I can go back and make it do something. So now I create a handler, and again, we'll talk about what that actually is, but essentially what it says is, whenever you get a click, do this, execute this code. Right? And then I associate that handler with the button. And notice that the actual JFrame is still executing. Right? So I'm changing the JFrame on the fly. I'm adding the handler, and now when I click this button, I get I execute this code, which prints thanks. So I can play around with the behavior of this button as I fool around with the code itself. And again, if I was going to do this in Java, what I'd have to do is I'd have to go back to the editor, I'd have to add this code, I'd have to make sure I declared all the other things I need to declare in order to be able to do this. Whereas here, I can just add, one, two statements, which, of course, one of the statements contains multiple lines. And I don't even have to stop it and re-execute it. It just adapts automatically and goes. That's very nice. It's a very nice way to play around with things like the graphics. You can extend the syntax. The scripting language doesn't have to be faithful to the Java language syntax. That's another nice thing about these JVM-based scripting languages. The other thing, though, is you need to have a consistent interpretation of the variant syntax, which can be a problem in some scripting languages. A scripting language can implement variant syntax to simplify Java features. Really friendly scripting languages let you define your own syntax, so it becomes a lot easier, for example, to set various attributes on the toolkit windowing toolkit features that you're playing with, as we saw on the previous slide, where I said, okay, now here's a mouse button handler. Just stick it in there and go. So here's an example of extended syntax. This one's perhaps a little obscure. This is running the bean shell in text mode. The previous one, of course, was in graphical user interface mode. So what do? I create a hash table. All right. And again, this is a very simple way. And there's also a problem here, which I will come back to in a minute. So I create a hash table. And again, notice I don't have to declare the type of the map. I don't have to declare map, for that matter. And this is an extension of the syntax. So I print get 1 from map, and nothing happens because it's null. There's nothing there. And then I put map, I put 1, the digit 1 associated with the text 1, print it again, and I get 1. So again, this allows you to play around with hash maps, see what they're like. Notice we have a change of syntax here. Now I have curly brackets as opposed to what I had up here. And essentially what I'm doing is, what am I doing here? Just speculation. What is the syntax replacing? It's replacing the get, right. So this is a redefinition of the get syntax. Rather than do this, do this. So there's an example of where I can redefine the syntax. And if I want to do it in a consistent way, I should allow this extension to appear both on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of an assignment statement, which is what we see here. So this is a redefinition of put, exactly. Now if I do a print map 2, I get 2. That extension is consistent, so I create a new J button. Okay. There's no label associated with that J button. That's the default. Now I can set a label. I can use set label. Or I can use this extension. And now if I print the... So I set the label here, and then I use this curly bracket extension on button to print the associated label. I can also do this. This is another extension. I can treat button.label as if it were... What do they call it in C-sharp? Attributes, I think. And do an assignment, and then do a print, and press to play. Okay, so this is an example of an extension to the syntax, a consistent extension of the syntax. And again, it's very nice because you don't have to do all this sort of stuff. All right, any questions about that? Now, there is one thing to note here, and I mentioned it up here. Does anybody know what that is offhand? It involves stuff that we haven't talked about yet. Hash table is a generic. It accepts two generic parameters, the type of the key and the type of the value being stored. Bean shell, I think most interpreters, although Groovy actually may, most of the interpreters do not understand generics. All right, so you won't be able to experiment with generics in Bean shell, certainly. Maybe Groovy does do that. I don't know if it's been updated since I last looked. But there are certain features in Java that you won't find in these scripting languages, which is kind of unfortunate because it's with generics that you'd really like to be able to experiment. The fact that you have an interactive runtime, the fact that in a sense you're sitting in front of this giant Java calculator is one way to think about it, has a lot of nice properties. The first one is it can demand less upfront information because you can add the information incrementally. You can add the information as you need it, which is one of the problems with programming in Java. I said Java was not fun. One of the reasons that Java is not fun is it requires you to declare up front everything you need. Okay, and this is another way that scripting languages can be more terse than Java, less verbose. It can also spend time to recover or discover information. Okay, which means that they generally tend to be less efficient than Java because, again, one of the advantages of having all this information up front is redundancy. Java can now perhaps assign more meaning to code because of this extra information. Scripting languages don't have that advantage or may not have that advantage, and so they have to either spend more time trying to recover that information or give up earlier. that's a fair trade-off for us because we're only looking at little pieces. You know, we're only doing experiments on snippets. And if the snippet doesn't work, oh, well, throw it away and start again. And if you're actually doing more heavyweight work, that may actually be a problem or not. It depends. So here's an example of runtime discovery. Here I create a method that's sort of floating in space, but I don't believe we're going to actually go into the details of this anytime in this course. But it's a method that takes two values and then adds them, returns the sum of the two of them, whatever that might be. And notice that there's no type on A or B. I don't know what that type is. Well, that could either be in Java an error, it's like bzz, you get a compilation error, or it's like, okay, fine. I call add with 1 and 2, I add those two things together, and surely enough, I get 3. Again, because the bean shell interpreter said, okay, what's the value associated with A? What is the type of that value? And it gets two integers and says, oh, I know how to add two integers, and it goes ahead and does it. Next, I call add with hello world. All right, two strings. Again, the same process. What's the value associated with A? It's hello. That's a string. And the other one's a string. I know how to add two strings. That's concatenation, and that's what you get. And then, of course, you can do weird things like, okay, here's a string and here's an int. Well, I know how to do that, right? Or maybe you don't know, but it, as we'll see, which you have a string plus int, that turns the int into a string. It actually calls the toString function associated with, toString method associated with this type and returns a string. So now you do the concatenation of those two and you get hello one. So here's an example of where you're relying on bean shell to discover the things that you would have to tell Java if you were writing a program. And again, that's very nice, particularly if you're doing exploratory programming. On the other hand, like I said, if you want to have robustness in your code or if you want to have efficiency, possibly, if the interpreter actually would exploit that, you can also add that. So, for example, I can indicate that add, in addition to accepting two integers, returns an integer. And now I can do this. That's okay, but now I can't do this because I'm saying that, oh, this should be an int, and it's not. It's a string, so that's a type error. So you get this error from bean shell. Again, this is probably something that we're not going to be very interested in. We're more interested in the exploratory aspects of using a scripting, an interpreted scripting language, but still, it's nice to know it's there. I guess I am going to talk about it. All right, so what is this? I said this was a method. And actually, I'm probably talking about things... Well, I can draw on your C++ experience. Right? If this is a method, where's the associated class? You can't have methods floating around in space. And because this is Java, you can only have methods. So the question is, this is a method, what's the associated class? That's the trick here. And the answer is the associated class is the environment. Essentially, the way bean shell sets up its semantics, it considers the environment to be a giant this class. So anything you create in the interpreter is essentially added as a component to the this class. So when you create a variable, that is an instance variable to the this class. When you create a method, that is a method to the this class. Definitions given in the environment can be used to implement interfaces or extend classes, is what I'm saying. So this is a way that you can incorporate existing classes or interfaces into your bean shell session. The environment is treated as a giant class instance for some anonymous class, which you can access via this. So that's how you get away with just saying, oh, here's a method with these parameters and do this whenever it's called. Here's an example of that. So again, I create a button, a frame. I add the button to the frame. I pack the frame in the environment. And then I set the frame visibility to true so you can actually see it. It doesn't do anything when you click. So what I will do is I will define an action that you can perform on that environment when, on the event of clicking. Okay, again, notice I don't have to declare the type here, which is good because I'd have to look it up because I don't remember what it is. I don't have to remember what the return value is here, which is good because I don't remember what that is and I have to look it up. And it prints the thanks message. And then, now this becomes a method in the this environment or the this class. And now I can just say, great, here's the action listener. Call the action listener for button and pass in this action listener. Because this is a, I shouldn't say this, because the action performance method is part of the action listener interface, this environment suddenly becomes an implementation of the action listener interface and is an acceptable parameter to the add action listener. Again, this is automatically going on via bean shell, the bean shell interpreter. So there's a whole mess of complicated stuff here that you don't have to do, that you would have to do if you are actually implementing this in Java, which is, we'll see when we get to the graphics part of the course. All right, so again, this is very nice, very simple way to explore things. Here is another example in the bean shell. So I define this drag text method. Okay, and then I get the graphics context. I set the color to cyan. I define another method which deals with the mouse move event. And I'm sorry, I have to keep these right. The mouse dragged event and then the mouse moved event. Mouse dragged is when you click the button and move the mouse. The mouse move event is just when the mouse moves. And then essentially if you're defining a mouse motion listener, these are the at least three of the methods that you have to define. Once you define them, this becomes an implementation of the mouse motion interface. And you can add this as a listener, and now if I drag the text around that I'm displaying, I'll be able to move it. Again, very straightforward implementation of this. Much more complicated if you're actually writing the Java code. I don't know why. Is there any difference between those two? No.
Another dot.
Where?
Up in the example.
Oh, yes, just another dot. I don't know why I did that. All right, so that's the scripting language. I recommend that you actually pick one of those and become familiar with it, because, like I said, it's a very nice way to explore various Java features very quickly. So, certainly, I think it's more important to figure your way around something like Bean Shell or Groovy or Peanuts than an IDE. Because it'll help you answer questions very much more quickly than you would using an IDE, even if it's a really whizzy one that just allows you to push buttons all the time. All right, any questions about that? Questions about the scripting part? All right, I just have a few more things to say. I'm not going to say that much about debuggers, because principally we've pretty much covered everything you need, right? Testing, find bugs, and scripting languages. That should be able to answer all your questions that way. And you should be able to do it, as they like to say these days, proactively. In other words, before things blow up, you can answer questions. But what do you do if things still blow up? Well, you can use a debugger. And there are some debuggers in Java. So assertions and testing should reduce the need for debuggers. Okay, they find problems early and they find them exactly. Because if you test this method and this method blows up, it's fairly clear where the problem is. Whereas if you have a program that blows up, what do you do now? Debuggers are usually integrated with an IDE, which is another reason I'm not going to say that much about it. So, for example, Eclipse has a debugger. I believe Java has one. Certainly the Emacs JDEE, you can use GDB. And the way in which it's integrated will depend upon the IDE that you're using. Java debugging itself, the JVM defines what's known as the Java Platform Debugger Architecture, or JPDA. This is another one of those examples of subsystems. If you remember the diagram that we talked about a week ago, we had that sort of triangular shape in the middle, and then we had these ellipses that were growing around the triangular shape, the language, the classes, and the runtime. Well, one of those ellipses was protocols, and this is an example of a set of protocols. So the JPDA consists of a set of three related protocols. There's the top, the middle, and the bottom level protocol. The top level protocol is the interface to the rest of the debugger. The bottom level is the interface to the JVM, and then the middle is the communication between the two. So you can actually have disparate debugging. You can debug on some other system and connect up to the JVM via the middle protocol. I'm not going to say anything about it. If you're interested, there's a link in the lecture notes that will take you to the page that gives you the extra information. Sun has included, and I think I pointed it out when we looked at the bin directory, a very simple text-based debugger called JDB. Okay, and it's mostly to illustrate how you would use the JPDA. It's in and of itself, it's not a very good debugger because it's very low level. You know, it does give you access to the stack frames and the variables, and you can poke around, but it's not very convenient. So you either want to embed that in an IDE, like I believe Eclipse does, and certainly Emacs does too, or you might want to just get a different debugger. There's lots of debuggers that you can use, either buy or download. Mostly, though, I guess most of them, or at least the reasonably good ones, you have to actually buy, which I don't recommend you do. All right, so that, I believe that's all I'm going to say about debugging. Any questions about that? Print, of course, what are you going to do? You're going to use print statements. That's the principal means of debugging. We'll actually talk a little bit about that when we get to, I believe, exception handling. So in summary, use Java 5 or Java 6 standard environment, J2, SE 5 or 6. Java is a relatively easy language to write tools for, very pleasant. I mean, it's one of the principal reasons I favor Java over C++ in production environments. Because you can write analysis tools very relatively easily on Java code, but it's just impossible on C++. Avail yourself of the tools that exist, and once you understand Java, try writing a couple of your own. Turns out to be fun. Nice way to learn Java, the ins and outs of Java, and may actually do something that you think is useful. Learn how to use Finebugs and JUnit, and then actually go ahead and use them. Also, pick a scripting language, learn how to use that, become familiar with it, and use that too. Maybe find a debugger if you can. If you find a good debugger, let me know. Use that too. I believe that's it. There is a Google Tech Talk. There's a link on the lecture notes, static analysis for software defect detection. Bill Paugh is the person who did Finebugs at the University of Maryland. So he has a talk at Google. Google uses Finebugs all over the place. He was there, when was this? 2 summers ago, I guess. So you might want to look that up and watch it. It's kind of interesting. And I believe that's it. Any questions? All right. Seeing no questions, I will see you next week. I will see you on Thursday.